but there's a lot I've left out too. In December 1830, the founding Mormon prophet Joseph Smith Jr. announced a revelation which established the doctrine of gathering the new church's members at a headquarters area. Wait a minute. Defining headquarters culture during the life of Joseph Smith is complicated by the fact that the church itself was experiencing fundamental changes and evolution. He periodically expanded Mormonism's doctrines and ecclesiastical structures, both of which significantly impacted the social dynamics at the church's center. Mormons living at Independence, Missouri from 1831 to 1833 clearly expected church headquarters to move there soon, which might have happened one day if mobs hadn't driven them out. Joseph Smith also found it necessary to move headquarters to Far West, Missouri in 1838, then to Nauvoo, Illinois in 1839. During the 13 years from the establishment of church headquarters in Kirtland to his death in June 1844, Mormons had limited opportunity to develop feelings of stability about the center of their church. Nevertheless, before Joseph Smith's martyrdom in 1844, LDS headquarters manifested various characteristics. Some of these remain constant, and I'll mention that I'm only mentioning six. There are actually about eight that I talked about, but again, in the interest of time. First, living at church headquarters involved abundant opportunities to see God's living prophet, both in church settings and in routine activities of daily life. Second, headquarters provided its residents with access to newly announced doctrines and with frequent opportunity of hearing church leaders discuss any doctrines as deeply as they wished. Third, the LDS Church gave the rank and file at headquarters the option of membership in special organizations that were unavailable to Mormons living far distant. Fourth, headquarters provided its residents with access to sacred ceremonies that were unavailable to other Mormons. Mormons at church headquarters experienced political power unavailable to Mormons living as a minority elsewhere. Sixth, because Mormons were usually the dominant population wherever LDS headquarters was located, they confronted the challenges faced by any majority which must coexist with minorities and with dissent. In religious, social, cultural, and psychological terms, church members at LDS headquarters have experienced Mormonism very differently from Mormons living elsewhere. Over time, this made the Mormon majority at headquarters culture a different breed, so to speak, from Mormons who lived as minorities. I see four stages in the continuities and changes of LDS headquarters culture. First, beginning with Joseph Smith's leadership from 1830, there are seats up here and in the middle. Beginning with Joseph Smith's leadership from 1830 to 1844 and continuing until Mormons abandoned church headquarters at Nauvoo in 1846 is the foundational period. Second, from Brigham Young's reestablishment of a permanent headquarters in Salt Lake City in 1847 until 1890 is the pioneer Utah period of consolidating Mormonism in the American West and confronting U.S. national culture. Third, from 1890 to the 1950s is the period of assimilating within U.S. culture while trying to maintain Utah Mormon distinctiveness. Fourth is the late 20th century period of responding to international growth and to America's culture wars while also trying to maintain Utah Mormon distinctiveness. The foundational period. Concerning personal interaction with the LDS president and other leaders, aside from audience participation at formal events, headquarters Mormons from 1830 onward had frequent opportunity to see their prophet in the ordinary activities of work, recreation, family, and local residency. By the mid-1830s, this personal access also included all other general authorities. By contrast, Mormons outside headquarters had few, if any, opportunities to encounter their leaders in such personally revealing ways. At best, Mormons outside headquarters saw their prophet and other general authorities as special visitors, usually in the formal setting of speakers at special meetings. Concerning access to doctrine, there were two periods during Joseph Smith's lifetime when this significantly excluded Mormons living outside church headquarters. Until publication of the Doctrine and Covenants in August 1835, Mormons generally had no access to the written documents their prophet was dictating to scribes, as thus saith the Lord, revelations from God. Those at headquarters learned about these revelations soon after scribes recorded them, and sometimes made copies for close associates. The more distant from headquarters in 1830 to 1835, the less likely believers were to have access to the newly written words of God. This was not an intentional exclusion, because in 1832 Mormon leaders began printing periodicals which informed Mormons generally of the Church's doctrines and gave the texts of some of these revelations. However, the existence of the official semi-monthly Times and Seasons from 1839 onward, Joseph Smith intentionally, despite that periodical, he intentionally omitted from its pages any reference to some of his most significant revelations and private teachings to trusted men and women. During the 1840s, this created a doctrinal elite at church headquarters. In other words, those with special knowledge of revelations, sacred teachings that were unavailable to Mormons outside headquarters. This doctrinal church within a church also excluded most Mormons at Nauvoo, whose understanding depended on what was presented at public meetings and official publications. These concealed doctrines of Joseph Smith's last years involved radically new meanings for the pre-1840s Mormon concepts, and all of these are existed before in published version. The word sealing and the meaning of these words, endowment, kingdom of God, the new and everlasting covenant, the restoration of all things, adoption, exaltation, and preexistence. These involve what later became known as marriage for time and all eternity, as plural marriage, as highly confidential rituals of the temple endowment, as the temple ceremony of adopting men to men, as the theocratic council of 50, and as the doctrine that men and women can become gods. The latter had the theological corollaries that God was once mortal, that God has a divine wife, and that the preexistence of all humans involved their being the literal offspring of God, the Father, and their heavenly mother goddess. While some of these teachings were rumored among the non-elite at Nauvoo, they were unknown to Mormons outside church headquarters until after Smith's death. So he finally spoke for hours at the April 1844 General Conference about his views of God and polytheism. The semi-monthly LDS newspaper did not publish a version of those remarks until months after his martyrdom in late June. Concerning special organizations for Mormons at headquarters, this began at Kirtland in January 1833 with the organization of the School of the Prophet. Aside from the opportunity to hear private instructions on doctrine and secular topics from the Prophet and other general authorities, members of the School of the Prophet had a form of initiation which stated that, quote, I receive you to fellowship in the determination that is fixed, immovable, and unchangeable. Be your friend and brother through the grace of God in the bonds of love, unquote. The next special organization for the rank and file at headquarters occurred at Far West, Missouri. Having been forced to abandon Kirtland as headquarters in December 1837 due to internal apostasy and due to lawsuits by non-Mormons, the Danite Order began at Far West, Missouri in June 1838 as a fraternal organization of self-protection for Mormon men who took blood oaths of loyalty and non-disclosure. It was organized to be under the supervision of the, quote, head, unquote, of modern Israel's, quote, War Department, unquote, a position held by Joseph Smith himself since 1835. Membership included First Presidency Counselor Hiram Smith and Assistant Counselor John Smith. Its formal existence ended after Mormon defeat in the virtual Civil War that raked Missouri in the closing months of 1838. At Nauvoo, Illinois, the church provided several special organizations for the rank and file. In January 1841, Smith organized a lyceum for men, and it was only men, who could give presentations on theology. On 15 March 1842, he organized Nauvoo's Masonic Lodge, which provided fraternal initiations and social activities for most of the city's adult Mormon males. 2 days later, he organized the Female Relief Society, which provided Nauvoo's LDS women with theological instruction, social activities, and opportunities for charitable service. In March 1843, there was an organization for Nauvoo's young men and women. Although Iowa Mormons also joined Mormon lodges of Freemasonry, this was available to them only because they lived across the Mississippi from LDS headquarters. Otherwise, none of these Mormon organizations were available to church members who were distant from headquarters, such as the thousands living in the eastern states and in the British Isles. Concerning access to sacred ceremonies, during Joseph Smith's life, this access was increasingly limited. In 1836, attenders at the Kirtland Temple received the ordinance of washing of feet from church leaders, as well as the anointing of their heads with olive oil and pronouncing a special blessing. Those who read about this in the LDS periodical from 1836 to 1837 knew that these ordinances were available only in Kirtland at headquarters. In August 1840, Nauvoo's Mormons began receiving baptism for the dead on behalf of their deceased relatives and friends. Though publicized in the Times and Season, which church members as far distant as Britain received as subscribers, this sacred ordinance was available only at headquarters, and all Mormons knew it. However, even at Nauvoo, very few knew that from May 1842 to May 1844, Joseph Smith privately initiated 66 living men and women into what they called the Anointed Quorum, those who had received the special ceremonies and instructions and obligations of the redefined endowment. Likewise, beginning September 1843, the married couples of this group began receiving the second anointing, by which living persons were pronounced as heavenly kings and queens for the eternities. In other words, they were given an ordinance on earth which declared them as gods in heaven. Concerning Mormon political power at LDS headquarters, this began at Ohio, increased in Missouri, and reached its nationally known apex in Illinois. After 3 years of constant immigration, regular Mormons from 1834 to 1837 held such civil offices in Kirtland as township trustee, treasurer, constable, election judge, election clerk, highway supervisor, and school examiner. Two members of the first presidency served as justices of the peace from 1836 to 1837. But this political power ended with the National Depression of 1837, which contributed to the disintegration of the church in Kirtland by the end of the year. When LDS headquarters moved to Far West in 1838, the Missouri legislature had already created Caldwell County, which surrounded them, as a Mormon county. However, at the end of the year, anti-Mormon Missourians were driving Mormons from the state by authority of Governor Boggs, and so there was a limited opportunity for real political power in Missouri. Because Illinois politicians were sympathetic to the plight of the Mormons in 1839 and eager to obtain their votes, and that's crucial, the legislature passed laws which allowed LDS headquarters of Nauvoo to become a nearly sovereign city-state. It was America's first example of theocracy, of ministerial theocracy, to be more precise, since the Puritans had specifically prohibited their ministers from holding civil office in Massachusetts. For example, LDS President Joseph Smith was Nauvoo's mayor, and the church's general authorities averaged two-thirds or more of the city council. In fact, Mormons filled nearly all of its civil offices and some of the county offices as well. While still mayor, Joseph Smith became candidate for U.S. president in 1843 to 44. Concerning the relationship of LDS headquarters culture with its minorities, non-Mormons had reasons to admire how America's first theocracy responded to those of differing religious views. In March 1841, the Nauvoo Ordinance stated that, quote, "The Catholics, Presbyterians, Methodists, Baptists, Latter-day Saints, Quakers, Episcopals, Universalists, Unitarians, Mohammedans, and all other religious sects and denominations whatever shall have free toleration and equal privileges in this city." Unquote. Freedom of religion was so strict that this Nauvoo ordinance even limited free speech by imposing $300 fine. That was huge at that time. $300 fine was mammoth. It would be like more than $30,000 caught now. It was an unbelievable amount of money. And 6 months imprisonment to anyone convicted of ridiculing a person's religious belief. Now they also had debtor's prison at that point, so anyone who got this fine was in deep doo-doo. By contrast, during the 1840s, the several states of the Union prohibited Jews, Muslims, infidels, and disbelieving Christians from voting or holding public office. That continued for decades in the United States as a whole. Nauvoo was an extraordinary exception. However, LDS headquarters was not tolerant regarding those perceived as enemies, especially Mormon apostates and dissenters. By his own account, and that of believers Brigham Young and Wolf Woodruff, the founding prophet sometimes slapped across the face, punched, or repeatedly kicked those who insulted him or his church. This included a Baptist minister at Kirtland, a tax collector in Nauvoo, his brother William Smith, Apostle David W. Patton, and 70s President Josiah Butterfield. In November 1836, 20 current general authorities, including the entire first presidency, joined 59 other Mormons in signing a warning to the non-Mormon justice of the peace in Kirtland, depart forthwith or else. In June 1838, Second Counselor Hiram Smith and Assistant Counselor John Smith joined 80 other Danites in writing a threatening letter to prominent Mormon dissenters at Far West, warning them, quote, to depart or a more fatal calamity shall befall you, unquote. Among those who fled for their lives were Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer, still faithful witnesses to the Book of Mormon, who had been excommunicated for dissenting against the policies of Joseph Smith. In June 1844, by request of Mayor Joseph Smith, the city council destroyed as a, quote, public nuisance, unquote, the dissenting Mormon newspaper Nauvoo Expositor. This led to his imprisonment in Carthage Jail, where a mob murdered him and his brother Hiram Smith. Under siege from anti-Mormons for the next 2 years at Nauvoo, Brigham Young and the apostles authorized the intimidation of apostates and dissenters at Nauvoo until he led the Mormons across to Mississippi en route to a new headquarters in the Great Basin. This led to a number of revenge killings of those who were perceived as anti-Mormons in Illinois. Moreover, by 1847, it was clear that the distinctions between headquarters culture and the rest of Mormonism had taken a terrible toll on the church since the death of Joseph Smith. Thousands of LDS members living distance from Nauvoo refused to believe that the Mormonism they knew up to June 1844 would be so different, vastly different, from the Mormonism Brigham Young claimed Joseph Smith had taught and had acted upon at church headquarters. This disaffection even extended to Nauvoo Mormons who were not privy to the inner circle's knowledge prior to the martyrdom. Therefore, 40-50% of pre-1844 Mormons refused to follow Young and his fellow apostles to the Salt Lake Valley. This led to changes in the headquarters culture of Pioneer Utah. The Pioneer Utah period of headquarters culture. In the Great Basin of the American West, Brigham Young wanted to give the widest expression possible to everything the martyr prophet had hoped for and done in the secret councils of Nauvoo. However, he did not want to duplicate Joseph Smith's pattern of separating headquarters from the rest of Mormonism. To the best of his ability, Brigham Young extended headquarters culture from Salt Lake City to encompass the entire Great Basin of Mormon towns and villages. Concerning personal interaction with the LDS president and other leaders, Brigham Young and several of his successors never left the headquarters in the American West to visit Mormons living in the Midwest, Eastern States, or South, in Britain, Europe, or the Pacific Islands. Throughout the balance of the 19th century, these Mormons had little or no contact with the LDS president. However, in this mission field, there were Mormons who remembered seeing the LDS president before they became president, as missionary or mission president. By contrast, in Brigham Young's expanded approach toward headquarters culture, the church president had frequent contact with pioneer Mormons living in a vast region of the American West. He visited settlements extending from southern Idaho to southern Utah, and by 1890, his successors, John Taylor and Wolford Woodruff, had visited Mormon communities in Arizona and Nevada. In addition, Brigham Young established quarterly conferences in every state, which corresponded to county boundaries at the time. And members of the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve routinely attended these two-day meetings throughout the Great Basin. General authorities sometimes also attended conferences of wards, especially whenever a new bishop was chosen. Even in towns hundreds of miles from Salt Lake City, pioneer Mormons had frequent visits from the church's general authorities, plus occasional visits from the LDS president himself. Moreover, Brigham Young extended the opportunities for regular Mormons to see general authorities in the routine activities of daily life, far distant from church headquarters. He assigned apostles to live for years at a time in the Bear Lake Valley of Southern Idaho, the Cache Valley of Northern Utah, in Box Elder County of Northern Utah, in Weaver Valley just north of Salt Lake City, in Iron County of Central Utah, in San Pete Valley of Central Utah, in St. George of Southern Utah, in Carson County and Valley, Nevada, and as far distant as San Bernardino, California. In his later years, Young himself left Salt Lake City each winter to reside in St. George. Like those at LDS headquarters, Mormons in various places of the Great Basin, extending as far as California, had daily opportunities to talk casually with general authorities, to see them at special events, or shopping, or with their children, or gardening at home. Personal interaction with Brigham Young and his fellow apostles had been important for many of the American and British Mormons who endured the succession crisis after the founding prophet's death. They followed Young to Utah because they knew him personally. Apparently, as a conscious decision, President Young extended that personal association far beyond the headquarters culture of Salt Lake City. After Brigham Young's death, several newly appointed general authorities voluntarily chose to live distant from Salt Lake City. For example, some of these general authorities lived for weeks at a time at the residence of their plural wives in Mormon settlements of southern Alberta, Canada, of Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, and northern Mexico. Even in Utah, some of the hierarchy's post-1877 appointments kept their main residence distant from headquarters, in Cache Valley, in Weaver Valley, in Davis County, in Tooele County, in Utah Valley, and in Chuab County. In an area of millions of square miles, Mormons had the same kind of personal association with general authorities as was true of headquarters culture in Salt Lake City. This pattern continued into the 20th century. Concerning access to doctrine, Brigham Young also made sure that there was little or no disparity between headquarters culture and the rest of Mormonism. Again, this avoided one of the contributing factors of the succession crisis that began in 1844. No matter how distant Mormon settlements were from Salt Lake City, Young expected their stake presidents to be at headquarters every April and October for general conference where they received instructions in doctrine and policy. Upon returning home, they reported this information to local Mormons. In the early decades of pioneer Utah, the local bishops were also required, attend conferences, and they also attended special meetings for bishops only. Beginning in 1850, Salt Lake City's Deseret News printed sermons by Brigham Young and the Apostles, many of whom explored deep doctrine and used salty humor. Very salty. All American Mormons were urged to subscribe. In 1853, the Journal of Discourses began its 33 years of reprinting for British Mormons those same Utah sermons. While many of these sermons emphasized the plain teachings of the Bible and LDS scriptures, church headquarters also expected that the newest converts throughout the English-speaking world would also read these eye-popping discussions of plural marriage, temple ordinances, Adam's God, blood atonement, and the political kingdom of God on earth. Brigham Young was determined that never again would church members apostatize for not knowing about the deep doctrines being taught at LDS headquarters. Concerning special organizations at headquarters, it was inevitable that some were available only to those pioneers living in or near Salt Lake City. Examples in 1855 were the Polythophical Society and the Deseret Theological Institute, both of which invited Salt Lake women to attend with the male participants. The Theocratic Council of 50 was another exception. But Brigham Young and his successor, John Taylor did initiate some men who resided hundreds of miles north or south of Salt Lake City. Since it had no meetings at all, however, from October 1851 to 1867, nor from October 1868 to 1880, nor any meetings at all after October 1844, Pioneer Mormons lost little more than secret prestige by lack of access to the primarily symbolic Council of 50. In other instances, Brigham Young wanted the special organizations at Salt Lake City to be widely available to other Mormons. For example, since 1842, all scheduled prayer circle meetings outside the temple were convened and directed by Joseph Smith or Brigham Young. In 1851, Young authorized separate organizations of prayer circles in Salt Lake City, some presided over by apostles and others by the city's bishops. First they met in homes, then in the Salt Lake Endowment House. Eventually every state and many wards throughout the Great Basin had their own prayer circle organizations, which met weekly or monthly for the true order of prayer, as originally taught when the individuals received their endowment. Also, again, it's a redefined endowment, not the endowment of the 1830s. Also, when Brigham Young renewed the School of the Prophets from 1867 to 1874, more than 900 men joined the Salt Lake City School, while approximately 5,000 others joined Schools of the Prophets in towns throughout the Great Basin. However, this was restricted to men. The most enduring and widespread were those special organizations that had been available only to Nauvoo's residents. No longer a counterpoint to Masonic lodges, which Brigham Young did not sponsor in Utah, the Relief Society extended itself from Salt Lake City in the 1850s to every ward of the Pioneer West, and ultimately women experienced this organization in every organization and congregation of the church. There was similar growth in the organizations for LDS young women and young men, which Brigham Young first reestablished among his daughters in 1869. Current Mormons do not realize how many sources of their weekly church activity were restricted during Joseph Smith's presidency to those living at LDS headquarters. Thanks to Brigham Young, many significant aspects of Mormon culture are no longer limited to headquarters culture. This might have also occurred had the founding prophet lived to age 85, as he expected, but things turned out differently. Concerning sacred ceremonies, Brigham Young also expanded the access, first numerically and then geographically. Whereas Joseph Smith gave the endowment ceremony to 66 living persons from 1842 to 1844, Young and his fellow apostles initiated more than 5,000 people in 2 months, from December 1845 to February 1846. However, all of this occurred at Nauvoo, and for the next three decades, Mormons had to travel to church headquarters to obtain the special endowment. There were practical reasons for this, but Brigham Young wanted to make the temple ordinances available far beyond Salt Lake City. A few months after laying the cornerstone for the Salt Lake Temple in 1853, he said that there would one day be a temple in Scotland. He later spoke of temples dotting the entire earth. Thus, it was no accident that the first temple Brigham Young dedicated in the Pioneer West was hundreds of miles distant from church headquarters. Moreover, in 1877, he closed Salt Lake City's endowment house, thus requiring headquarters Mormons to travel for days to St. George in order to obtain their temple ordinances. His successor, John Taylor, reversed that policy, but Young had established a goal for the Mormon hierarchy to think globally about temples. The fulfillment would not begin until the 20th century. Concerning Mormon political power at LDS headquarters, Brigham Young exceeded the example of Nauvoo's theocracy by exerting direct control of political life in Salt Lake City throughout the Great Basin. Until 1850, he was governor of the theocratic state of Deseret. Then, from 1850 to 1857, he was federally appointed governor of the territory of Utah. From 1850 to the 1880s, the Utah legislature was usually 100% Mormon. He also attended city council and told them how to vote. Current general authorities comprised from one-third to one-half of the Utah legislature. From 1872 until his death in 1877, Brigham Young formally became a member of the Salt Lake City Council and still told them how to vote, even though he wasn't mayor. But this political power extended far beyond formal office. For 20 years, Before he formally joined the Salt Lake State Council, he gave them instructions how to vote. From 1848 until his death, Brigham Young arranged for the nomination of the church's candidates from southern Idaho to southern Utah, informing district communities of his choices by mail and then later by telegram. He decided who would be mayors of Salt Lake City and all other large towns of Utah and southern Idaho. During these years, more than 99% of the votes went to church-approved candidates. After the elections, Brigham Young privately met with Mormon legislators, informing them how to vote on various bills, and likewise communicating his wishes on various matters to mayors throughout the Great Basin. Even years after his death, 99% of southern Idaho's votes went to church-approved candidates, while 82.6% of Utah's votes went to candidates of the church's own political party as late as 1882. Although the 1880s federal campaign against Mormon polygamy and theocracy diminished the Mormon church's political power, LDS headquarters continued to give voting instructions to obedient Mormons from southern Idaho to northern Arizona. This succeeded in the election of nearly all headquarters-approved candidates until 1890, when the church's political party lost control of both Ogden and Salt Lake City. Concerning the relationship of LDS headquarters culture with its minorities, during these years of Great Basin theocracy, there was primarily conflict. Catholics, Protestants, and Jews lived in a culture where their religious freedom was guaranteed, but their political expression was irrelevant. After the California Gold Rush of 1849, Salt Lake City's non-Mormon population swelled into the hundreds, primarily males, and the next two decades were filled with violent incidents expressed along religious lines. LDS leadership did not encourage this, but actually created a culture of violence with sermons, congregational hymns, newspaper editorials, and patriarchal blessings, invoking the memories of past persecution while urging vengeance against Mormon's enemies and blood atonement against the wicked of the flock. By the 1880s, there were thousands of non-Mormons, now with a larger proportion of families, and located primarily in Salt Lake City and Ogden. In the late 1880s, the church's two official newspapers continued to praise those who physically attacked Mormon dissidents, government officials, or newspaper reporters regarded as anti-Mormon. Similar to the domain of Mormon theocracy, these confrontational attitudes extended from headquarters culture throughout the Great Basin. As a result of this religious polarization, the Salt Lake Ministerial Association and Protestant clergy, pardon me, could somebody bring me a glass of water from the back? Unused, preferably. None unused? Okay, we'll pass then. I'll just have to croak my way through it. I'm just getting over a cold. I can't take the chance. I'll horse my way through it. As a result of this polarization, the Salt Lake Ministerial Association of Protestant Clergy published attacks on the LDS Church and urged Congress to pass legislation against Mormons as individuals and against the LDS Church as an organization. That is well known. The LDS President's official abandonment of polygamy in September 1890 began tremendous changes in Mormon culture. It was, which now sought political and social accommodation with non-Mormon society. It was as if Wilford Woodruff's manifesto had flipped the switch, changing Mormon power from D.C. to A.C. The period of assimilating. Thank you. Thank you very much. Concerning personal interaction with the LDS president and other leaders, in the period from 1890 to the 1950s, rank-and-file Mormons continued to have frequent access to the general authorities. Extending from Washington, D.C. to southern Alberta to northern Mexico to California to Hawaii, organized stakes had four conferences a year, each of which was attended by general authorities, usually at least one apostle, and sometimes the LDS president. Moreover, virtually anyone could walk into the church offices at 47 East South Temple in Salt Lake City without prior arrangement and meet with a member of the First Presidency or Quorum of the 12 Apostles. It was not unusual for these walk-ins to chat with the general members for more than half an hour. As LDS world membership reached 1 million and then more, this traditional characteristic of LDS headquarters made its culture seem increasingly privileged. Concerning access to doctrine, beginning with President Woodruff's 1895 request for church members to stop worrying about, quote, who God is, unquote, LDS headquarters began retreating from the freewheeling theology of Brigham Young and other leaders. By the end of the decade, James E. Talmage, not yet a general authority, produced the first systematic presentation of LDS theology, titled The Articles of Faith. This book had been revised by a committee of apostles and was soon translated into the languages of European Mormons. Nevertheless, for more than 60 years, editors of church magazines, both at headquarters and in the missions, published articles which referred to some of this speculative theology that appeared first in the Journal of Discourse. In addition, because few general authorities spoke from prepared text until the late 1950s, audience at general conferences and state conference might hear impromptu echoes of the old-time religion and also frontier humor. And the continued survival of J. Golden Kimball stories is a manifestation of that. This was most frequent for those living at headquarters and nearby. Nevertheless, by the 1930s, some were so disillusioned with this retreat from pioneer Utah theology that they began a cottage industry of publishing excerpts or full reprints from Journal of Discourses about plural marriage, Adam God, the United Order, and other topics discomforting to the 20th century headquarters. In the 1840s, Mormonism's church within a church was the radical creation of Joseph Smith. In the 1930s, it was the reactionary creation of Mormon fundamentalism. Growing presence in headquarters culture has haunted LDS leaders ever since. Concerning special organizations for Mormons at headquarters, in 1929, the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve decided to disband all private prayer circle organizations that had been meeting weekly or monthly in the temple. At that time, four in Utah, one in Canada, one in Arizona, and one in Hawaii. How things have changed. The private circles meeting in the Salt Lake Temple had existed continuously since 1851, more than 40 years before its completion. This 1829 decision cited the inequality of hundreds of thousands of faithful Mormons who could not have this privilege. This was the Utah leadership's first official acknowledgement of the disparity between headquarters culture and the rest of Mormonism. Nevertheless, for nearly 50 more years, the First Presidency allowed states to have prayer circle meetings in the temple or in special rooms of state meeting houses. As far as I was able to determine by reading their minutes and attendance rolls, this occurred primarily in Canada, Idaho, Utah, and Arizona. While prayer circle rooms were unknown in the growing number of stake meeting houses elsewhere in the United States and the world. Concerning access to sacred ceremony, whether or not they knew about the special prayer circle meetings of the West stakes in America, the faithful knew that LDS temples were beyond their reach if they lived outside headquarters. By the 20th century, there were more Mormons living within an easy train ride of London than lived near the temple in Manti, Utah. Nevertheless, beginning with Joseph F. Smith, LDS president since 1903 had declared an end to the doctrine of gathering and asked European Mormons in particular to remain where they were converted. This was a futile request for those who knew that it cost little more to emigrate to Utah than it cost to visit there for temple ordinances. By the 1950s, this applied to hundreds of thousands of Mormons east of the Rocky Mountains, south of Arizona, south and west of Hawaii. And so beginning in 1955, David O. McKay, who had eagerly promoted international Mormonism since the 1920s, dedicated temples in Switzerland, Los Angeles, New Zealand, England, Oakland, California. For the headquarters Mormons, it seemed a fast-paced expansion of temples, but as the saying goes, they hadn't seen nothing yet. Concerning Mormon political power at LDS headquarters, for 70 years after 1890, Mormon political power was at its lowest level before or since. Politically, Mormonism experienced a Babylonian captivity, as six LDS presidents struggled with the consequences of surrendering theocracy and accepting the divisive world of partisan politics. In 1891, the LDS Church dissolved its political party, and general authorities began publicly combating each other as Democrats and Republicans. Increasingly, the rank and file made their political decisions independently and ignored the First Presidency's political signals. The lowest point began in 1933, when Mormon voters defied President Heber J. Grant and Utah became the swing state to ratify the repeal of national prohibition of alcoholic drinks. 3 years later, the Deseret News published a front-page editorial against the re-election of Franklin D. Roosevelt, and every letter of complaint to the first presidency correctly identified its author as first presidency counselor J. Reuben Clark, and condemned the first presidency in no uncertain terms for publishing such an editorial, and all these people signed their names, in many cases giving their ward position or stake position. Nevertheless, nearly 70% of Utah's voters, despite these editorials, helped re-elect FDR in 1936, as they did in 1940 and again in 1944. In 1953-54, LDS headquarters experienced two major political defeats. First, in January 1953, Mormon members of the Utah legislature ignored emphatic instructions by an editorial in the Deseret News to override the non-Mormon governor's veto of a bill which required all businesses to close on Sunday. Several apostles had lobbied the Mormon legislators to pass the bill. After the governor vetoed it as religious discrimination against Jews and Seventh-day Adventists, the legislature, overwhelmingly Mormon, declined to override him as instructed by headquarters. Within months, church headquarters began a new campaign to reapportion the Utah legislature. LDS apostles openly supported reapportionment with this explanation. Quote, "If this proposal is passed, the church will control 26 of 29 state senators," unquote. Church welfare trucks dropped vote yes pamphlets at LDS meeting houses. Does this sound vague and familiar? And local bishops read vote yes statements at sacrament meetings. But the next does not sound familiar. Nevertheless, Utah's primarily Mormon voters defeated reapportionment, and despite this overwhelming campaign, in 1954 by a vote of 143,000 to 80,000. In 1960, David O. McKay publicly expressed his hope that a Republican candidate, who shall remain nameless, would be elected U.S. president. A survey of active Mormons that year showed that 43% said that the LDS president, quote, was not inspired in making this announcement. In the 25 counties of Idaho, Utah, and Nevada, with 90 to 100% LDS population, there were 98,000 votes for the Democratic candidate, John F. Kennedy. Concerning the relationship of LDS headquarters culture with its minority, after 1890, the church newspaper no longer praised violence against anti-Mormons or critics, and there were no incidents of this kind. However, because polygamous marriages continued to exist, and the LDS church still tried, often unsuccessfully, to exercise political influence, Salt Lake City's Protestant clergy continued its anti-Mormon propaganda and lobbying of Congress. Concerning Mormon dissidents, beginning in 1910, church presidents encouraged the investigation and excommunication of those who continued to advocate plural marriage. Regarded as apostates, this campaign against Mormon fundamentalists became most intense from the 1930s to 1950s. However, with the exception of Apostle Mark E. Peterson, LDS leaders did not regard as apostates those Mormons who dissented from policies or pronouncements of the first presidency. For example, from the 1930s to 1950s, church members signed their names to letters denouncing official statements by the first presidency and denouncing conference talks by its members. Yet local leaders were not contacted with instructions to investigate and discipline these dissident believers. In the current. By the 1930s, there was no longer any conflict with the Protestant churches at LDS headquarters, but tensions had begun with the Catholic diocese there, which I'm going to skip over. With regard to ethnic minorities, the first half of the 20th century showed well-intentioned ambivalence as the percentage of Mormons in Salt Lake City steadily declined. The first presidency donated toward the construction of the city's first synagogue in 1903, praised Simon Bamberger after his election in 1916 as Utah's first Jewish governor, and in the 1950s made substantial purchases of bonds issued by the State of Israel. However, during the 1930s, the first presidency rebuffed German Jews who asked its administrative help for them to escape the Nazis. These were, in many cases, members of the church, the LDS church. And in the 1950s, the first presidency arranged for legislation requiring Utah's Jews to close their businesses on Sundays as well as on their Jewish Sabbath. Aside from excluding persons of black African descent from priesthood ordination, the first presidency down to the 1950s defended an official correspondence its policies for excluding African Americans from church-owned hotels and for segregating Negro blood in LDS hospitals. At the same time, the first presidency quietly supported the exclusion of African Americans from white neighborhoods in Utah, Arizona, California, while privately opposing civil rights legislation. David O. McKay commented, quote, "The South knows how to handle them," unquote, and he privately complained about, quote, "insolent," unquote, Negroes who wanted equal rights. All right, the period of responding to international growth into America's culture wars. Concerning personal interaction with the LDS president and other leaders, in the 40 years since 1960, worldwide church membership has increased from 12 million to nearly 12, from 2 million to nearly 12 million, with more than half currently living outside the United States. Nevertheless, following David O. McKay's example, LDS presidents have traveled by jet throughout the world, speaking to large meetings of Mormons and dedicating dozens of temples. Mormons outside the U.S. today have seen the LDS president and other general authorities to a degree unknown among non-U.S. Mormons before 1950. Nevertheless, for decades, LDS presidents continue to have normal associations within their neighborhoods or residents. However, during the 1980s, LDS headquarters isolated the living quarters of the LDS president from regular neighbors, initially because of his physical deterioration, but later because the church security department wanted a controlled residence environment for protective surveillance. This moved the church president first to the Hotel Utah and later to a first presidency floor of the rebuilt Eagle Gate apartment, also isolated from regular neighbors are the living quarters in the Eagle Gate of presidency counselors. Now the vast majority of Mormons living at headquarters have no closer association with the LDS president than Mormons living in Boston, London, Tokyo, or Mexico City. Not only has it become impossible for the rank and file to make unscheduled visits with general authorities, but even headquarters—well, I'll pass this on—but even those who previously were at headquarters feel that they are now deprived of this. Concerning access to doctrine, the single most important effect of the LDS correlation program from the 1960s onward was limiting the access of Mormons to doctrinal commentary and to historical discussion with doctrinal implications. This required abolishing the traditional magazines at LDS headquarters and in the mission so that Mormons everywhere would read only articles that had been approved by the correlation committee at headquarters. Whereas Brigham Young wanted the newest converts anywhere in the world to have access to the deep doctrines being taught at headquarters in Pioneer, Utah, the correlation program since the 1960s has wanted headquarters Mormons to know nothing more doctrinally than what the newest converts are taught anywhere in the world. Not surprisingly, this has caused Mormons with traditional headquarters culture background to promote open forums for discussion of experience, doctrine, policy in both past and present. Concerning special organizations for Mormons at headquarters, as a direct response to international growth, the first presidency in 1978 announced the discontinuation of the prayer circle meetings, which had continued in the West Stakes since 1929. In 1991, following the annual Sunstone Symposium in Salt Lake City, a statement of the first presidency and Quorum of the Twelve denounced such a symposium. Concerning access to sacred ceremonies, following the example of David O. McKay and fulfilling the prophecy of Brigham Young, LDS presidents to the present from Spencer W. Kimball have built multiple temples throughout the world. The count now is more than 100, with a new temple being dedicated this Sunday. Interestingly enough, in Nauvoo. While President Kimball resumed the second anointing ceremony after decades of its non-performance, he restricted it to the Salt Lake Temple. By last information I have, the only temple which has a functioning Holy of Holies room. Concerning Mormon political power at LDS headquarters, as is well known, LDS headquarters has managed to reverse the 1890s-1950s pattern of rank-and-file resistance against political instructions from headquarters. A major factor was that from the early 1860s onward, LDS publications and the general authorities encouraged an unprecedented adoration of the church president. Now, speaking politically against the will of the first president is very difficult when nearly all church members talk about the prophet in hushed tones. That has recreated the kind of lockstep obedience to instructions politically that existed prior to 1890. And also important in this was the development of culture wars in the United States. Focused originally on racial freedom, they extended the issues of social protest, civil disobedience, conscientious objection to war, recreational drugs, women's rights, birth control, non-marital sex, abortion, homosexuality, and educational experimentation. And this has combined with this adoration of the prophet to make an overwhelming mix of religious devotion combined with a conservative concern, I could say paranoia, but the combination of the two has been hugely important in reestablishing this lockstep obedience of the mass of the rank and file. Concerning the relationship of LDS headquarters with its minorities, and I'm just about done, in 1960, LDS headquarters began patching up its longstanding conflicts with the LDS Church, and I'll summarize that very quickly by saying they are now political. There's been a less happy relationship of LDS headquarters with its minority of self-proclaimed intellectuals and inquiring Mormons. Although the first presidency encouraged openness in research and publication of Mormon history during the early 1970s, this gradually declined. Important in that decline was the influence of apostles such as Hal Benson, Marquis Peterson, and Boyd K. Packer. In a similar development, the academic openness and rigor encouraged by Dallin H. Oaks at Brigham Young University in the 1970s withered under the same apostolic influences, until, as mandated by church headquarters, BYU distinguished itself in the 1990s by firing or forcing to retire numerous professors whose scholarship seemed threatening despite their protestations of faith. In 1992, the first presidency acknowledged that there was a special committee at headquarters whose sole purpose was to maintain and continues to files on church members and notify their local leaders to, quote, take appropriate action for instances of speaking publicly or publications about controversial topics, including letters to the newspapers. The disciplining of 6 Utah scholars and feminists in September 1993 for their publications and Sunstone talks sent a message of intimidation to independently minded Mormons throughout the world. Think what you will, but speak and write at the peril of your church membership. Conclusion. One paragraph. There are many ways of understanding the Mormon experience, which has been varied at headquarters and in far distant branches of the faithful. Both Mormons and non-Mormons may find useful understanding through comparing the experience of Mormonism at LDS headquarters with the Mormon experience elsewhere. And current Mormons who feel that their church has changed in dramatic ways may find parts of their own experience in such comparison. Thank you.
Officially, the time is up, but we don't have anything more scheduled, if I read the program correctly, until after dinner. So, as far as I'm concerned, you can all stay and we can talk to Mike as long as he's up to it. What do you say?
Well, I would say that I don't want to interfere on people's dinner plans, which may involve going into the city. So, I would say at most 15 more minutes and then I will answer no more questions for the group as a whole. Okay. But those of you who want to leave right now are welcome to do so.
Do you want to go ahead and take the question?
Yeah, I'll just take Q&A. Yeah. I'll just do 15 minutes of Q&A.
Yes.
Do you foresee this getting better in the near future as far as the churches
that... Okay, I don't know where the microphone is. Oh, one right there. I see it. All right, I'll repeat the question for the benefit of the listening audience. The question is, do I see anything getting better in terms of certain trends that some might regard as negative in the LDS Church? My answer is no. I do not see light at the end of the tunnel because I do not think it is a tunnel. I think it is a mine shaft. Next question.
This is not the first religious organization that has begun. Has anybody ever done any studies on other organizations compare how they've developed compared to the Mormons, or vice versa?
How it changes over time?
The Catholic Church, or the Seventh-day Adventist,
yes. These kinds of studies have primarily been since the 60s, and in the Christian tradition, process theology has been a part of that, looking not only at theology, but looking at institutional change. That has been very common in all the traditions of Christianity and, you know, all the traditions of Judaism. It has been less common with Islam, and the situation there is no central authority, and Islam is a different kind of situation. But of the people of the book, the Christian tradition and the Jewish tradition have both had this examination of change over time. With Islam, it has tended to has primarily been focused on regions. So Islamic change within Saudi Arabia, to the degree that there has been history, Islamic change in more liberal communities such as Egypt. It has tended to be focused on by country in that respect. Yes.
You mentioned about how that the new manuals make sure that no one in Salt Lake is taught anything more than the new converts in Africa or Asia. Everywhere I go, I hear complaints about this, that the conservative people are really getting fed, that they're just frustrated as can be over these very dull college lessons and the same 10 topics over and over again. Is this going to change, or do you sense any sense that this might be changed?
Two questions. I forgot to repeat the question for the last answer I gave. And this is cart ahead of Horace. But for the previous question I answered, the question was about other traditions, whether other religious traditions have had analyses of change over time in those traditions. On this question, the one now being asked to me is that in view of the fact that there are rumblings of dissatisfaction among Mormons who are very devout, in many cases very socially and politically conservative, over I don't want to use a negative term, but over the standardization and the simplification of lesson manuals and publications of the LDS Church, do I see, in view of that, widespread grumbling and dissatisfaction of the potential of change? Well, I don't want to overstate my negative perception of things. For one thing, historians are terrible prophets. But I do see a huge resistance at the headquarters against doing things other than they want to do them. There are two factors operating there. One is the insularity and the fact that even though they go out and they talk to regional representatives, the state presidents, those state presidents tell them what they want to hear. And so you have a circularity of point of view in that respect. You also have a closed intellectual, a closed logical system. And in that closed system, it's not totally closed, but the tendency is that for every outcome simply reinforces the original premise. So that if people resist what Church Headquarters has done, it's because they're faithless. If people praise what they're done, it's because God has spoken. And with that point of view, there is a limited, it's not there's no, but there's a limited option for change. However, when people they trust, and that's a huge issue, people they trust indicate misgivings. That can play toward the front. And that people they trust can be people that are regional leader or an area leader trust, and that area leader may report back that concern by a person that area leader trusts, or perhaps the area leader himself may have certain misgivings about the lesson manuals or whatever, and that can be reported back. But that's how it happens, and it happens very slow, and basically it has to happen from people they trust. Everyone else they dismiss as either misguided or as as Satan's tools, and therefore God's enemies. Yes?
How extensive today is the second anointing
ceremony? I can comment on that. I have statistics only up until the 1940s for the second anointing, and it's how, the question was how common is it. I can only say that in the 1970s, after Spencer W. Kimball became president,
I was in the position of knowing people who were close to him, who were commenting at their surprise that the ordinance was being administered at all. And some of them had never heard of it until the presidency of Spencer W. Kimball. And you can find reference to this even in some published references. But I have no knowledge of the numbers. I didn't even at the time. It was all anecdotal, even in the 1970s, when I learned about it very close to people who were close to him. Other questions? Yes.
You mentioned one comment about David O. McKay. Is that consistent? I've heard other things that would present David O. McKay's attitude in a more favorable way.
There's a question about my quoting David O. McKay in terms of his attitudes endorsing segregation and Jim Crow South, which he did. And I didn't quote, but he also in that same statement to a state president spoke against the efforts in Arizona to pass legislation to bring equal rights to blacks. To understand David O. McKay, you need to understand that he was being loved. And he would say whatever he felt would be, you know, would encourage that from people he was talking with. So if he was talking to a Mormon liberal like Sterling McMurrin, he would say things that would encourage Sterling McMurrin to tell him how wonderful he was. If he was talking to a segregationist and a racist from Arizona, the way he was in 1948, he told that man what he thought would encourage him. In many ways, he was a chameleon. He certainly had views, he certainly had strong positions, but you really have to understand that he had this need to be loved. And where his attitudes were, where will the real David O. McKay really stand up to speak from a game show that was common during the later stages of his life? That may not be easy to know, because everything he wrote, everything he said, he filtered through that need to be accepted and loved by people. All I can say is that he privately wrote things that seemed to endorse the civil rights for blacks. Within, at the same time, and sometimes after, he had made statements concerning the need to keep them in their place. But I do think the evidence indicates that even though he spoke to his audience, that David O. McKay did not have egalitarian views. He had views that wanted blacks in their place. And I'm going to go into the evidence for that. I talk about that in an upcoming publication. But I think the evidence is very clear that even if many of you have attitudes toward J. Reuben Clark, his counselor for 10 years, and J. Reuben Clark's attitudes toward the civil rights of African Americans was more liberal than David O. McKay, and David O. McKay prevented him from giving a talk in 1954 endorsing full civil rights for African Americans. And the reason J. Reuben Clark wanted to do it was because he had this ironclad reverence for decisions of the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in 1954 had said separate is inherently unequal. And Reuben felt it would be in the best interest of the church to go on record as soon as possible to, from the point of view of a political and social conservative, to endorse full civil rights for African Americans. And David O. McKay would not allow him to give that talk. So I think privately he had views that many would consider racist. Yes, towards the front.
Church headquarters, to a very modern-day, formidable public relations effort, is doing a very good job of bailing water and keeping a homogenized message throughout the worldwide media. With the coming of the Olympic Games in Salt Lake City, how do you see those efforts to be maintained and for journalists to get true facts?
The question is, how do I see the attitudes of the LDS Church toward public relations and media in relation to the effect of the 2002 Olympics in Utah? Well, the LDS Church has this interesting, and it's not an unusual, attitude toward the media. They love it as long as they can control it.
But the fact remains that the LDS Church cannot control the media. And so they're pleased any time the media will report favorably on the LDS Church and quote extensively from the position of headquarters that's issued by either its spokespeople or by such people as the president of the church himself. But even if there's only one sentence out of a four-page article in, say, like Newsweek or Time that refers to a quoting a dissident point of view or a view that headquarters would prefer not to be expressed, headquarters sees that as a kind of stab in the back by the media. Headquarters does not have the perception of the media as being balanced. And so because headquarters is really only two steps away from a siege mentality, it wants the media to present them in a non-anti-Mormon way. And any way that is not in the terminology, in the review of LDS headquarters, is anti-Mormon. And the media has a hell of a time dealing with that point of view, because the media wants to present balance, and the LDS Church does not want balance. And so, increasingly, the frustration of LDS headquarters is going to grow with the 2002 Olympics, because you're going to have international news organizations who want to get many sides of the story. All sides, no one can get. But many sides of the story of the Olympics, and the story of Utah, the story of the church-state that exists in Utah. And the LDS Church is going to have a lot of frustration. It has sent out media packets, and when those are used, it celebrates. But any time the representatives of the media interview somebody from even the dissident community is an overstatement, just somebody who presents a non-correlated view of the world of Utah or the world of the church, LDS headquarters just wrings its collective hands in really sincere disappointment, because it sees those things as anti-Mormon. A question at the back.
Is there anything like the Temple of the 50 that takes those plateau that the church has had in these matters?
The question has been anything like Council of 50, and by that I'll have to be an oath-bound organization that is dedicated to theocracy since in the 20th century. And the answer to that is no. I do not believe in a conspiracy theory. The LDS Church has done things in private, secret, to bring about political actions that I think are reprehensible. But I do not see that in the kind of conspiratorial way that people do who have that view of the world. So, no, the Council of 50 was truly a conspiracy in its way, but it was a good conspiracy from the point of view of the LDS Church. And so it was simply the Kingdom of God. If they wanted to give any name to the organization, that was what they called it. And that has not existed. The church today really doesn't have a theocratic point of view. It does have a view of absolute control. And they're not the same. And the church wants to exert control wherever it can. But it really, those men who occupy those offices as prophets, seers, and revelators, they are as far removed as Mormons could be. And I will have to say Mormons could be from a theocratic worldview of, say, Brigham Young. They simply don't have that mindset. They do want control. That's very clear. There was a question in the middle.
Does the public press appreciate
last question
that the information that is disseminated from the church public relations is directed in this image-making process, and do they understand it with the appreciation that they need to go beyond that to look and really see what are the issues and what are the people in the church and are surrounding the church and within the state addressing as issues that have to be looked at?
The question is, do the media and representatives of the media, the various people involved in gathering information, do they recognize that there's a need to go beyond the publicity pact that LDS headquarters issues? That really depends, because the media includes stringers for organizations, and they may not have if the organization doesn't give priority, the stringer may not do more than simply contact headquarters. However, on an issue as focused in national and international attention as the Olympics, even student reports are going to be hard-hitting because of the stakes involved. That's a different kind of situation. But generally, it depends. And even reporters from Time and Newsweek, depending on the issue over the years, sometimes have not gone beyond church headquarters. It just depends. But typically, the high-profile organizations, Time, Newsweek, big network news agencies, when they go out and they interview people, they want to get more than just the church formal response. So you do have that diversity. I'm afraid people who can come up, want to come up, can come up, but I don't want to interfere with any of those who are planning, maybe already have dinner dates and dinner plans involved with travel into the city. So we're going to end Q&A now.